Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the deputy editor and chief critic, joined as always by our editor at large, Ann Thompson. And I'm back from weeks and weeks in Europe, and you're still holding down the fort in Los Angeles. And boy, we've got a lot of stuff to work through because as we accelerate towards the fall season, it just seems like each week brings a big news story. And while we've known about Birth of a Nation ever since it kind of exploded at Sundance, won the grand jury prize, Nate Parker's story has been a big kind of dramatic tale that's been reiterated many times since then. It really took a dramatic turn just in the past week when the stories of this rape scandal from his college days came up, and it just kept getting worse for him. So not only have people been dealing with this backstory, but then the news came out that the woman who accused him of rape in college committed suicide a number of years back. And while he has issued a very specific statement saying how bad he feels about this, in the context of a movie like this, which most people have not seen yet, but has so much buzz out of the festival circuit and it hasn't even finished its festival run, you really have to wonder, how do you dig yourself out of this hole, or is it even possible?
There are any number of questions that have been raised by this controversy, and it's really a situation that I've been watching Hollywood a long time, and I dug into the scandal archives to see where the precedents might be. And in the past, you know, a lot of people have gotten into trouble. You know, Robert Mitchum smoked dope, but he was sort of known as a bad boy. That was part of his image and his charm. Robert Downey took drugs, you know, he cleaned up and everybody, you know, supported him and felt good about that. And, you know, he engendered a lot of warmth and people genuinely liked him and so somebody like Elia Kazan, you know, ratted on his friends during the McCarthy era, and you know, these are Oscar worthy, you know, top of the line people. Someone like Nate Parker, I mean, then you can go into the sexual abuse scandals that involve Roman Polanski, who was nominated for two Oscars before and won an Oscar after. Woody Allen, despite whatever swirling accusations are out there. It's the same, you know, it's basically the same thing for 20 years being brought up over and over and over again. So he's really, you know, weathering that and doesn't seem to be punished for it by the community. They look at the work and they try to separate the artist from the work, and in most cases. But this is different because this man, Nate Parker, is unknown for the most part. The IndieWire universe maybe knows him, you know, from the independent community, from the Fox Searchlight movie he did before. They knew him before for The Secret Life of Bees, or from the two, that was Gina Prince-Bythewaite. He went on to do Beyond the Lights with her. He did David Lowery's Ain't Them Body Saints. He's a really good actor. He pops. I had had him pegged already. He was in a Spike Lee movie, Red Hook, the one in Brooklyn. I mean, he actually is incredibly gifted and was working the rounds, the Oscar circuit, after Sundance last year. And you know, Fox Searchlight has been, spent $17.5 million. They got the movie away from Netflix, which offered 20. And he was obviously hoping, they were obviously counting on some kind of real post Oscars So White, you know, trajectory for this film from the beginning. It was positioned as a front runner, not just by me, but by many other Oscar watchers. So now they have to go back to an a square one, which is that they're opening the movie. They're taking it to Toronto. He's doing interviews. He's doing public appearances. He's supposedly doing a college promo tour where I guess the subject of rape is going to be added to the agenda, which was supposed to be about revisiting the history of Nat Turner and the slave rebellion in 1831 and all of that history that he wanted to bring back into the current conversation. And so the movie that played so well at Sundance will hopefully play well again, and they will be able to get the movie open. The long-term impact on him, it remains to be seen. A lot of people will not forgive him for what he did.
Well, one thing that I was thinking about just in terms of how people feel about this movie and how conversations develop about this movie is that from the critical standpoint, this was not a universally beloved movie. There was a certain kind of enthusiasm around it that I think was partly because it's an emotionally involving story. It's reclaiming a certain kind of narrative, you know, the sort of Braveheart dynamic of this powerful male figure sort of leading a revolution for the Black community. And so there's a historical reckoning taking place and a certain cultural weight associated with this movie that's, I think, much stronger than the filmmaking, which is a little iffy in parts. I wasn't blown away by this movie. And there are a lot of critics, I think, who are almost afraid to wrestle with this kind of material and say that they don't like it. I mean, it's a little too cheesy for some people in some parts. And I don't know how that's going to translate into its award season prospect, but couldn't, on some level, this be another kind of additional burden to a movie that wasn't necessarily a slam dunk Best Picture winner? I mean, it's not, it was never a surefire bet right out of Sundance just because a lot of people liked it.
Well, the different candidates for the, I mean, there's two ways of dealing with this. On the one hand, I think it's unfortunate to saddle such a movie from a first-time filmmaker who has not been established as a director or a writer. He co-wrote this. He is very much established as an emerging, rising actor. But he this is putting Oscars on top of this. It's sort of like Selma in a way, you know. But in that case, Ava DuVernay had several movies under her belt, had already emerged out of Sundance with The Middle of Nowhere. I mean, she really was, you know, fine. And I think it was appropriate to put her, more appropriate, really, to put her into the Oscar conversation. You're always setting yourself up in a situation like this. But now the whole thing is, you know, you recognize a news cycle when you see it, you know, how something develops and moves on and takes on extra life. It keeps morphing, you know. So you were right. At first, there was a Deadline story about the rape scandal, which, by the way, was on his Wikipedia page. It was out there. It was something the Fox Searchlight people knew about. It was there. But they didn't know about the woman
committing
suicide. And so, I mean, well, what I get back is basically that she was an anonymous rape accuser, that there's a, you know, people don't identify people who have been, you know, accusing people, you know, who have been raped. They don't do it. And so I think perhaps they thought that it would stay that way. What they didn't they didn't do the shoe leather reporting that Variety did. And Variety went and found the brother and found out what happened. And that's the story that really has done damage, because it portrays a troubled woman who never recovered from this incident.
Well, also, I mean, we live in a hypersensitive society at this point in time, and the word rape is so charged that anybody associated with it, I mean, you have to do your due diligence with anything that's being subjected to public scrutiny. And I think it seems like there was one extra step that needed to be taken here, because what I think seems to have happened is that there are two cultural phenomena going on here. One is the kind of charged nature of this movie's existence, and the other is the charged nature of today's sexual politics and the way that we're sensitive about certain things. And I think very progressive in appropriate ways, but now they're overlapping in a way that can is problematic for both ends. I mean, Roxane Gay, who's this great columnist in the Times, African-American woman, terrific writer, who often wrestles with issues of race this week, in her column said that Birth of a Nation is being billed as an important movie. I haven't seen it yet, and now I won't. And I feel like that seeing that overlap is really what suggests that a real storm has kind of
amassed. I find that disturbing, though. You know, I'm not going to. I actually think there's something to be said for keeping an open mind. I mean, I remember when Mel Gibson was going, you know, was being very, you know, there's an example of someone who hasn't been forgiven. And he really, yeah. He really, you know, crossed too many lines for too many people, even if he was drunk, even if he, you know, his hate demons emerge when he's out of control. Those hate demons being uttered by a man like Mel Gibson were unforgivable, you know. And so a lot of people wouldn't go see his Jesus Christ, the Passion of the Christ movie. And I understand that, especially since a lot of people felt that the movie had anti-Semitic elements in it, which was very much a question of the eye of the beholder, I think, in that case. But where you are with not seeing Birth of a Nation, I don't know. I mean, I think the movie is the movie. The movie should be judged on its own merits.
Yeah, I mean, it is a troublesome dimension to our culture, but it's also just the reality of the world that we live in right now, which is that we're just going through so many different change processes that everything seems like it's a sensitive, point that could create some sort of huge backlash. I mean, look at this year's election, for example. But looking back at the more specific context of award season, right now our Oscar pages have the top front runners for Best Picture as Birth of a Nation, Loving, Manchester by the Sea.
I'm going to have to go. All right, here's where I was going before. So what I was going to say before is that if you look at the overall picture of what's emerging as other Oscar contenders in the Oscar race, I have always wondered how Birth of a Nation really was going to play with the Academy. And because it is a very tough, very, it isn't like 12 Years a Slave in the sense that 12 Years a Slave is definitely an art film. It is an extraordinary formal aesthetic achievement on every level.
And so this is a great movie.
And this is much more of a populist, emotional, you know, action drama. You know, it shows you the horrors of slavery. It shows you why they rose up against their masters, and it gets you caught up in that whole, drama. It's not a reserved and controlled. It's not the same thing at all. And so this may not. I would say that it's easier, probably, for people to embrace and like a movie like Loving, which is a loving marriage. It shows injustice in a different way. I'm not saying they're very different movies, but there's also Marshall that might come into the fray. There's a whole slew of movies that are actually in you know, there's Fences. There's so many movies that the Oscar drama is going to be so diverse this year compared to last. The Birth of a Nation doesn't just coast in on its merits on that level anymore.
Right. Well, we haven't seen Barry Jenkins' Moonlight, which
that's another one.
Seems to be another black cast, black director that seems to be gathering a lot of momentum. So I think that element is kind of fascinating because it seems almost like even without this specific scandal, this wouldn't necessarily be the movie that defines the kind of desire for more diverse storytelling in award season this year. You know, having said that, Manchester by the Sea has none of those things. So, in the context of that narrative, it doesn't have as much going for it. But maybe in other ways, once it plays at more festivals, it'll gain some additional momentum just because people like it, which is something a completely separate factor as well. But before we get further into what the fall season is looking like, let's take a few steps back, because the last time we spoke, we had a couple new releases that I had seen and I really wanted to dig into with you, but you didn't have a chance to get to them yet. So now you have. So
yes, I caught up with the movies I was supposed to see,
yes.
And you did not catch up with the one you. Which, and I'll tell you why. I was eager to see. I had missed various screenings of both Hell or High Water. Actually, that was more a case of I missed the links expired that they sent me as well. But I ended up going to see it in the theater, and that was better. I highly recommend seeing Hell or High Water in the theater, and Pete's Dragon too should be seen in the theater. And I was eager to see them. You were not eager to see Florence Foster Jenkins.
I looked around, unfortunately, in the small islands in Greece that preoccupied my days over the past week. They were still stuck in last year's mode. The Good Dinosaur was playing in Mykonos, so I didn't feel like reliving that path. But maybe if at some point before the end of the year, I'll try to squeeze it in. But Hell or High Water, let's start with that one, because it's still playing around. And I think it's a really neat movie. It's a fun genre picture of sorts with some really strong performances from David McKenzie in a totally different mode than he was in with his last film, Startup, wouldn't you say?
This is a very entertaining, accessible, good-looking, well-written, well-acted film. And what I loved about it more than anything was the structure of it, because you think you're really not sure. It isn't a genre film of any kind. It has elements of heist movies because it's, you know, robberies. It has elements of Western stuff like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, in the sense that you've got these two guys running in and out of banks. And then you've got the ranger, the Texas Ranger, the older guy, the cliche of the about to be retired detective played by Jeff Bridges. But I loved the banter between him and his half Mexican, half Indian, if you like, sidekick. The joke is that he's always making fun of him as an Indian,
and then he's kind of racist, but the Indian guy's kind of used to it.
And they love each other. You can tell they absolutely adore each other. And then you have the two brothers played by Chris Pine. And Ben Foster, and they're very good. But you don't know. It isn't like those two guys, especially, are not easily pegged as one particular trope that you would be familiar with. You're exploring it as you go along, and as the movie unravels, you begin to see what really there's a whole other twist to the story that is very satisfying, and it's interesting because the ads that sell the movie are telling you that it's a sort of anti-bank, the way that that even positions them as sort of Robin Hood figures. The movie is quite well done, I think.
Well, and you have to give credit to the screenwriter Taylor Sheridan, who's what he's doing is playing with certain kinds of tropes, but also playing against expectations. So I would say that it does satisfy expectations of a genre film, in the sense that if you want to see this sort of Western landscape with some great car crashes and shootouts, it's all there. But it also provides, it uses those things in a very interesting way to play against your sympathies and expectations. So it's sort of above average for this kind of material. Doesn't always, I think, completely come together, but it's very strong. And I also wonder if it's the kind of thing where, these are well-known actors at the top of their game. And I would love to see more movies that are like this, that are sort of playing with our awareness of certain kinds of genres.
I agree with that, because, especially, we've seen Ben Foster do a lot of really good work before, but in indie films. But Chris Pine, I saw him on the stage. He's actually an extraordinarily good stage actor.
Yeah, and he was good last year in Z for Zachariah.
I was going to bring that up. And then he did an interview that you talked to him about. You talked to him about this, because it's important for these actors to get away from just doing Star track. This guy's a more, and he has more going on, you know, than he didn't do well when he tried to do Tom Clancy. This guy's a better actor than he is a movie star. And I think we should encourage him to keep looking for parts that expand his range. And then the other movie that Pete's Dragon is interesting too, because it's an independent filmmaker who worked inside the Disney combine. And there's absolutely no way this isn't, I mean, you have to expect it to be a Disney family movie, and Bryce Dice Howard is you know, has limitations as an actress, but the movie is so sweet. It is, and to compare this to the BFG, David Lowery does a whole lot better making dragon believable and inhabit the space and inhabit the geography, even if it's on a big scale. There are no moments in this movie where you're going, is that dragon really there? How did they get that dragon on the truck? How did they get the little the little boy to sit inside? And the little boy is magical, just fabulous. How did they get him to sit inside the, you know, the hand of the dragon? And the character of the dragon is totally believable. So that's animation, and it was beautifully, beautifully modulated, controlled by the director.
And there's a tactility to the way that the special effects look in this movie. And I wrote a little bit about this as well. And Lowery is a filmmaker, somebody who maybe a lot of people haven't known about super well, even if they saw Ain't Them Body Saints, but he's been making shorts for years. They're all online, and I recommend people track them down, because there's always been a strain of sort of fantasy storytelling in his work, and there are even handmade effects and stop motion and all these kinds of things. And what you see here is that you need somebody with a trained eye who is sympathetic to the needs of an audience to believe the world they're being given in order to be engrossed by it. And so something really pays off here in the kind of symbiosis of a smart filmmaker with a particular vision and a studio with specific needs. Now, I don't know if this is the big commercial hit of the summer. It doesn't seem to be designed for that, but it does send a good message, right? Because this is a guy who's going to do Peter Pan next. You have other younger filmmakers who are going into the system now exploring these kinds of possibilities. And as much of a naysayer as I usually am about this process, and I'd like to see people tackling original stories.
Oh, we're not worried about David Lowery. He's going to go off and do some really cool things.
Somebody to explore that.
Yeah, he has. Yeah. He's, what's great about him is that he's an artist with a voice who we already know. And so what we can recognize in this movie is that voice didn't get lost. It's still there. And it's his movie. That's the sign of a real filmmaker who has authority and has already developed his identity. So even if he is able to adapt himself to the demands of a Disney family movie, he still maintained his integrity as a filmmaker.
Well, shoot, Anne, we're agreeing about too much this week. We have to find some point of division here.
On that note, I'm going to take off because I've got to go do an interview, and we will leave our discussions of Toronto and New York to another time.
It's all around the corner. Much more to come. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.